I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members in your packets, you should have the minutes. Representative Johnson, you want to move the minutes for today?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson moves the minutes for today of January 18th, 2017. Members, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The January 18th minutes are adopted. Members, today we're doing an overview of the Department of Veterans Affairs. We're first going to go over some of the financials. Ms. Roberts, can you kind of give us a little overview, if you would? In your packet, members, you should have some of these details. And maybe if you want to start with the transfer piece, and then we can kind of go from there.
Madam Chair and member, again, you'll see the same reports that you've seen from the other agencies, and the first ones are the transfer reports from the budget system. And for Department of Veterans Affairs, there are two reports. One is the transfers in from other agencies, which is a pretty short report. You'll see there's, for example, a transfer in from public safety for a World War II memorial donation, and then some transfers related to the GI Bill administration, and probably the most one of most interest would be the transfer in for the Support Our Troops, and that's from the license plate revenues, and then the department receives a part of those revenues and then expends them. The other transfer report you'll see will be the transfers out, so those are transfers out to other agencies, and I think you'll see, again, some familiar items that you will see for all the agencies, for example, the Enterprise Sustainability Office, the Statewide Executive Recruiter, and the Governor's Special Revenue. We've had some conversations about those types of transfers. And I think it's probably might be more helpful for each of those items for me to pull them, all of the transfers for each item together, and you can see them in one piece, so agency by agency. So those, again, you've seen those before for other agencies. The other items in your packet are the, again, the agency budget structure with funds, which shows some of the legal citations to, and this is to supplement the information that you had requested in the letter to the agencies. And then you'll also see two reports that are the reports that show expenditures by object code. And I ran two different ones. I think this is a good illustration of where the fund comes into play. So there's a general fund report by object code, and if you look at it, you'll see that's where primarily the veteran services program of the department is primarily funded through the general fund. The second report is from the special revenue fund, and that is, most of that is all for the veterans health care program. As we get into the department's budget, you'll see that we do a direct general fund appropriation for the Veterans Health Program, but that money from the general fund is then transferred into a special revenue fund along with the federal per diem payments and the individuals' payment per diems, and then the money is expended out of that. So when you look at the department's budget, you'll see that the spending for the health care portion all comes out of this special revenue fund.
Members, any questions to these so far? Ms. Roberts, I do have a question on the transfers out provision. Remind me again, what's the Better Government Initiative, MAD?
Madam Chair, I think we might want to ask the department that. I know that was a governor's initiative. I believe it had to do with, could be wrong, with some sort of like results management sort of activities, but several of the agencies do have that transfer to the Better Government Initiative, and I think I'd prefer if the agency has information on that. Maybe they can explain it.
And before we do that, Ms. Roberts, the other one is, so is the Governor's Special Revenue Fund, is that the same federal office issue, or is that something different, or what is that?
Madam Chair and members, that is the same transfer you'll see for most of the cabinet agencies, and again, I'd like to clarify, it's not just for the federal activities, it's also to cover the expenses for the legislative staff at the governor's office, the sort of the government relations staff that deals directly with the legislature. Some of the staff that you would probably be talking to, their salaries are often paid for through these contributions from other agencies.
Okay. And to the department, to on the first question, what the Better Initiative piece was, and then on the governor's initiative, it's been different, the amount for each agency. So were you given like a percentage that you had to do from your budget, or how was that amount determined? Can you tell me that?
Madam Chair, I am John Powers, the Finance Director for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Can you speak up too, please?
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powers. I'm the Finance Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. To your question, the initial question, I believe, the Better Government Initiative, are we looking at the $5,000 in FY14? And I believe that was a transfer to, well, it went to Minnesota Management and Budget, but I believe that was a program that they had back then. It was an initiative to improve efficiencies, I believe. But it's been back in 14, and I don't necessarily recall what it is, but we can certainly find that out for you.
If you could, I think that would be helpful for us, and if you have more details of how the funds were used.
Madam Chair, what was the other question?
And the other question was, on the Governor's Special Revenue Fund, were you given a certain percentage based upon what your budget is, or how was your amount determined? Because each agency has been slightly different. I think I want to say MMB and Revenue had the same amount. It was about 20.4, I think, was what their amount was. But I see that your guys' is less, at least. So can you tell me what were you told as far as when you were given the amount that you had to put forward, what that was based on?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not entirely sure how they arrived at that. I believe it's based upon our general fund appropriation. And in fact, they may have looked at just the programs and services side to determine that, because we do, in fact, transfer that over into the health care fund, the good majority of the general fund that we receive.
Okay.
So I believe it's based on the amount of general fund that we get.
Mr. Powers, if you can maybe get information on that, I think that would be helpful too. Okay. And for now, members, any other questions? Representative Ubum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a quick one. I noticed your Home Central IT, pretty diversified with Laverne and Hastings and so on and so forth. Do you interact with Minute at all to save any money in these services, or what is your relationship with Minnesota IT?
Mr. Powell.
Representative, well, initially they were part of us, and back in, I believe, 2012, the employees were transferred over to Minute, but they work for us. And we work with them, and they continue to provide the same services that they've always provided. You know, they provide basic infrastructure support, and they manage projects. They do projects for us that we determine mutually together what would benefit the agency as a whole. So we do in fact work with them.
Yes, just a follow up. So how does that relationship, or how do you determine some of your in-house IT services, particularly in these outlying areas? How do you determine the costs as far as if you could use centralized Minute services versus these outstate standalones?
Ms. Powers?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe typically we have a governance team that meets with Minute, which is, in fact, over the last couple of years has gotten more robust, I guess you could say, because initially it was basically, this is what we're going to do. This Minute would say, this is, you know, you need another line coming into the home in Laverne because you have the line, if it got severed, you need to have a backup. So they would make recommendations that we would do something like that, and then, of course, they would calculate the charge and say that, you know, we're going to bill you for this. And typically that's the way it happens. So we have enterprise services that they provide, but then they also provide projects. They'll give us an idea what a particular project will cost and whether it's going to fit within our budget to be able to do that.
One last follow-up. Well, okay, so minutes billing you. Are you happy with that? Do we have some redundancy here? There's obviously no competition for minute in this type of situation.
Mr. Powers.
Madam Chair, Representative, overall we're happy with what they're providing us. It's been sort of a struggle the last few years to be able to sort of get everybody on the same page, and they have sort of their rules that we have to abide by. We did have some difficulty during the last biennium and moving forward as far as budgeting wise as to what they were actually would budget for. And in our particular case, during the last biennium, they indicated to me toward the last part of during the negotiations for the setup of our 16-17 budget, they indicated to me that they were going to spend beyond an additional $2.5 million between March and the end of the fiscal year, and that never did occur. So it threw off the estimates that I believe that we would have in the reserve account within the homes operations. So that if I had any angst about it, that's where it would be within the budgeting area. But I think overall they provide the services that we need, and they do contract out. For instance, where our SharePoint is becoming more robust, and they contract that out to get a contractor in to help with that. So when they don't have the expertise or the knowledge or the time, for that matter, to get the work done, that they will contract out to get those services done for us.
Representative Ugo.
Madam Chair, well, just a final thought. I mean, you know, Minute's a captive, they have a captive market with you guys, and I'm just hopeful that when we look at this budgeting process and things, the billings for Minute, which pretty much they're deciding on what they're going to bill you, are appropriate when you combine them with possibly going out to the private sector. So, thank you.
Any other questions, members? Does anybody else, is there a problem with the technology over there? I'm hearing this kind of, you hear it too, okay. All right. So. I just want to make sure that we're getting taped and. Is it gone now? Okay. Okay. All right. Great. With that, a couple of things for today's purposes. I'd like you to go over, last year you came with a supplemental request kind of at the very tail end. I'd like you to walk through what led to that emergency need. And I'd also like for you to, and at some point we are going to have you come back to go over the preliminary results of the legislative auditor's report. And members might have some questions about that today, but we will do a different hearing just on that piece alone. But I would be interested in knowing the lead up to the emergency request that you asked for last year. What created that as well? But with that, if you want to start and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Commissioner Shelto is unable to make it today, but I brought along both Mr. Powers has introduced himself, as well as Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, who's a Deputy Commissioner for Programs and Services Division, as well as Deputy Commissioner Hughes, is a Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Health Care. That is the veterans' home side. So I'm going to be walking through a mission and overview of the agency. Mr. Powers will take over talking through some of our budget and funding slides, and then we will work through the healthcare division and the programs and services division. Any questions that that I'm not able to address, I'm going to call on one of the deputy commissioners to try and answer more fully. And feel free to interrupt with any questions as they arise.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is dedicated to serving Minnesota veterans and their families, and by extension, the communities that they live in. The way we do that is to maximize the quality of life through programs and services, as well as services at the Minnesota State Veterans Homes located at five different sites throughout the state of Minnesota. Current numbers, we serve approximately 361,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota, which represents approximately 7% of the state's population. Of Minnesotans aged 65 and older, just under a quarter are veterans, and of those 75 and older, it's closer to a third of the population. And the most recent numbers we have is that since September 11, 2001, 76,412 veterans. It's an updated number as of this morning. 76,412 Minnesota veterans have been discharged from active duty, with 445,651 of those serving in a combat zone. For a point of reference, this is a breakdown of Minnesota veterans by period of service. As you can see, World War II and Korea, those numbers have been diminishing over the past decade or so. And relating to the discussion about veterans' homes and programs and services, you can see the Vietnam-era veterans are our largest portion of the veterans' population. And the Gulf War and other service periods are peacetime veterans represent the next two chunks. And on the right-hand side is a breakdown by gender. Currently, veterans in the state of Minnesota, men make up about 93%, and women make up about 7%. But those numbers are expected to change. The number of women serving in active duty has increased significantly. I think it currently makes up about 12% of the active duty force. And we expect that by 2020, the number of women veterans in the state of Minnesota will be over 10%. We serve veterans in all 87 counties, and the primary way we achieve that service is through partnerships with county veteran service officers. These are positions that are mandated in state law. So every county has a veteran service officer, and those with larger veteran populations have a stronger veteran service officer present, more veteran service officers than assistant veteran service officers. We also partner with veteran service organizations such as the American Legion, VFW, DAV, Paralyzed Veterans, and so forth. As well as federal VA, the St. Paul Claims Office and the Minneapolis VA and St. Cloud VA healthcare systems are strong partners. And I'd like to highlight that the money that the state of Minnesota uses to support MDVA, approximately $70 million in general fund appropriations, actually results in more than $2.6 billion annually in federal benefits and services for veterans. And this is a number that we look at as this is money coming back into the state of Minnesota. Call it the Veterans Enterprise, but it is in the form of post 9/11 GI Bill benefits, healthcare services, compensation and pension claims, veteran home loans. So we really do get a lot of value from the money that the state of Minnesota provides to MDVA to utilize on behalf of veterans and their families. Both in the slideshow and as a handout, I've included a breakdown of our organizational chart. Again, Commissioner Shalito, Brad Lindsay and Douglas Hughes are the deputy commissioners. They're here today. And Mike McElhenney, some of you are familiar with, is the chief of staff. And the breakdown is as it appears there, programs and services under Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, the veterans' homes and health care underneath Deputy Commissioner Hughes, and then central staff, which is all of the affiliated central HR, legislative communications, in-house counsel, and so forth. So MDVA has approximately 1,182 FTEs. We're closer to 1,300 actual employees, but the healthcare side has a number of employees who are not full-time. and that is a result of the scheduling necessity of having health service technicians and nursing care providing 24/7 service. But in terms of FTE, that's the breakdown. And in terms of workforce by location, you'll see that the largest of our veterans' homes in terms of both residents and employees is at Minneapolis. Central office and programs and services make up about 8%. And then each of the greater Minnesota homes, Fergus, Hastings, Laverne, and Silver Bay, all represent between 10 and 15%. The breakdowns are as noted there. I introduce again, John Powers is our finance director. He'll be walking through some of our base budget numbers. And then I'll be following. Chair?
Yep. Mr. Powers, just a quick question for you. You're 3% for the central office. Is that a sort of a centralized administration for all the others? So is that like a shared use? Do you cover all the administrivia for the other locations through there? Shared services? Yes or no?
Chair? The makeup of that is the legislative staff, finance staff, human resources. Let's see what else is in there. The commissioner, the deputy commissioners are in there. So, yes, they service the homes, and they service the people that are working in the programs and services also.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yep. Mr. Chair, committee members, MDVA's 2016-17 base budget consists of $300 million biannual budget. That's all funds. $142.8 million of that is from a direct general fund appropriation, of which about $110 million of that is transferred into the Veterans Health Care or the Special Revenue Fund. Nearly $33 million is used for programs and services for the biennium. And for the biennium, we also received a general fund appropriation of about $12 million for the Minnesota GI Bill. $145.1 million is from federal appropriations and other sources. And of that amount, $95.3 million is from VA per diem reimbursements and resident maintenance charges for the veterans' homes. During fiscal year 16-17, we had federal construction grants of $43.4 million, of which the bulk of it is currently being built right now is Building 22, and then the Preston and Duluth cemeteries. Preston Cemetery has now been completed, and we are now currently working. We received an $8.3 million federal grant to build the Duluth Cemetery. We also received $2.4 million for the biennium and special revenue funds from the SOT or Support Our Troops license plates revenues and VA cemetery reimbursements. $4.1 million consists of resident trust and gift accounts. This next slide depicts our expenditures by fund. On the left-hand side, we have 12% of it is spent in the general fund, and that's primarily for veteran services. And what you see here, as opposed to a previous slide, is because that amount is transferred into the special revenue fund while we receive a general fund appropriation, it gets moved into the special revenue fund. That's why you see 70% of our expenditures occur within that fund. We have 15% of federal expenditures and then some smaller amounts for restricted special revenue trust and gift accounts. Moving to the center there, the expenditures by programs and services makes up 14% of the expenditures, and 86% is for the veterans' homes. Moving to the right there, expenditures by category, 60% of our expenditures consist of compensation, salaries, and benefits, 21% operating expenditures, 7% for grants, aids, and subsidies, and 11% for capital outlay for real property.
You on there? Oh, yes, we are. All right.
So at the request of Representative Anderson yesterday, we received an email indicating that you wanted to go over sort of the breakdown of the expenditures that occur within each of these programs. So what I provided here, this next slide, shows for programs and services, and we'll tackle this one first, and then we'll go back to the health care. I've got some additional information on the health care, being that is the largest piece of our budget. I've got some additional information about revenues and
how those are created. Terry Anderson.
Well, and I appreciate you going through these numbers. I mean, this was the request that we had back in December of a letter that we had sent to all the different agencies of information that we're looking for. And I assume that you're going to get to the point, but for members here on the committee, we have 12 out of the 17 members that are brand new to the committee. And I just, for their purposes, I want to highlight what we experienced in the last session where there was a request made by your agency for $7 million. Our omnibus bill contained that $7 million. The day that we were presenting the bill on the House floor was when your agency came out and had an additional $10 million request. And so that was outside of the governor's first supplemental budget and his second supplemental budget. And so I'm curious, when the governor puts out his budget here next week, I'm anticipating that there will not be another situation where we're presenting the bill on the House floor and that you will be coming with another additional amount of money needed for the agency. I mean, we're not talking small dollars either. We gave you the $7 million, then you came back for an additional $10 million as we were putting that through the House process months later. So if you can kind of go over that, I think that would be helpful. But for members of the committee, I thought it would be good for you to know the history for that.
To the question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, committee members, as you may know, state agencies are required to put their budgets in by October. This is what you see of our budget right now, which is for 18 and 19. At that time, we determined that we were going to have to make some significant cuts in order to maintain a reasonable reserve balance within the homes, okay? We met with the governor's office, and we showed them, we asked for these additional amounts. The additional amounts that we were asking for was direct by MMB for us to look at our average increase in FTE costs. And so that's what I did. I went back and I looked to see on the healthcare side what our average FTE costs were. And what we saw was from 13 to 14, we had a 5.8% increase in our FTE costs. From 14 to 15, we had an additional 5% increase in FTE costs. For the homes, it amounted to nearly $5 million of additional costs that we've had to absorb over the last few bienniums. And so we presented that to the governor, and our initial ask was $5.7 million. The governor indicated that he would support his initial proposal was $2 million the first year, and I believe it was 4.2 the next year. It stayed that way. It seemed to me that that's what he was going to propose to the legislature, okay? What we did start looking at, though, is our revenues had leveled off, and this was having an impact. Our revenues were leveled off, and we had to sort of predict what the future was going to be. And being our revenues are difficult to estimate, given the makeup of the veterans and the spouses that are entering the homes or exiting the homes, we have no way of determining exactly, because there's quite a significant difference between somebody that's considered over 70% disabled versus someone that's less than 70% disabled. There's a, and I can show you this later on how that occurred or the difference between that. So that was a factor in the fact that our revenues at that time, and in fact, we were anticipating a 3% increase to our revenues, but as the year progressed, we could see that wasn't going to occur. And so we continued to meet with the governor's office and suggest to him that we were going to have to make some significant cuts. And it wasn't until the end where we actually met with the governor's office and we met with MMB, and they were having difficulties with our budget when it came to trying to figure out the homes and how that revenue flow of it coming in and the amount of general fund money that was needed to support that. And so Commissioner France and his team, they said we were going to go back and actually look at what they felt we would need, okay, based on certain assumptions.
Mr. Powers, if I could briefly stop you. So I've heard you mention a lack of tools, or you're trying to predict things, and I'm just wondering, what is it you're using to come up with your anticipated numbers and increases? Because I haven't heard of any tools that you're using. You said that a little bit earlier, it seemed to me, and I just want to make sure that you're actually using some predictive modeling or something to achieve these numbers, because I haven't really heard that yet.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, primarily we use past history. That's what we have to use, because we really don't know, because it's a first come, first serve based on when they come into the home. We're not, it's not determined if they're medically needed to come into the home right away, or if they're severely disabled, that they're going to get headline of privileges. So when they come into the home, they may be 70% disabled, and they'll get the higher per diem rate, which, incidentally, the difference between the higher per diem rate versus the lower per diem rate is $123,000 a year, okay? So we have to look at past trends, and that's basically the tools that we use.
Okay. And then if you could tell us, heavy increase in admissions in the last number of years, growth trends over time, because it sounds like there must have been a spike at one time. If you could maybe give us some details there. And you can feel free to phone a friend, to quote Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, no, our census numbers have remained fairly consistent, other than in the Hastings home, where we have the ability, we have 200 beds there, but we're currently running at about 140 census, and that is because of sort of the community outreach nonprofit programs that are taking these other veterans in. So the veterans within that setting, that care, are getting help elsewhere too, and they sort of have a, they can choose where they want to go now. So other than that, the other homes are fairly consistent. The census numbers have remained the same.
So
the makeup of those residents changes, though. That's what is sort of unpredictable.
So if you're saying that the census stays fairly flat, but the needs of those that are there is what's causing this delta that you were unable to predict, or am I hearing that wrong?
That can be the case too. However, we don't know, if we look here, let's see, the residents that are coming into the home, if they are a low per diem, if they receive the low per diem, then it's based, their cost of care that they have to pay in order to stay there is based upon their ability to pay. So if their ability to pay, if they can't pay, then the general fund picks that up.
Okay, and before you proceed, is that what generated the $17 million delta that from what you foresaw and what you had to wind up asking for? In
Mr. Chair, committee members, again, I guess back to this, the story I was telling. So I was looking at it one way. My initial ask was based on the average FTE, okay? And in the March, end of March, early April is when we met with the governor's office, and that is when MMB decided that they were going to take a look at it. And it wasn't just looking at the salary increases. It was looking at the enterprise, if you will, for the homes and what they felt we would need to operate and have a reserve moving forward, given the uncertainty of future costs that, you know, future revenue, future costs, salary costs that we would have to incur. So they decided to take a look at it, and they had to make certain assumptions about the revenues. They had to make certain assumptions about our ending balance for FY15. And again, there was some information that was given to me by Minute that indicated that they were going to spend a certain amount before the end of the year. And it also occurred within our homes. We had a couple homes that we had implemented a new budget reporting mechanism, which they were to determine what their actual expenditures salary expenditures were in a given year. And what some of them were reporting was what they actually had budgeted. And so that was another couple million dollars there. We also had the total amount on the reserve at the end of fiscal year 15 was projected to be about $3.5 million. At the end of FY18, the actual was $8.9 million. So the difference was about $5.5 million. And that was because of what was being reported, what was being told to me. And so we had to make certain assumptions around that. And that's what MMB used as estimates as to what we would need.
I've got a couple of member questions. Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Powers.
Representative Anderson.
What have you done for this go-around to avoid that problem going forward? And then, and did you say that you have $8.9 million in reserve right now?
Actually, it's about, right now we're estimating it to be about $10.5 million.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, and so, and what have you done to rectify this so that when you're doing your prediction, you're not going to come in April or May to say we're going to need an X amount of dollars? And then are you on schedule for the $10.5 million to expend that by the end of the fiscal year?
Mr. Powers.
Chairman, Representative Anderson, committee members, what we've done now is, I mean, we meet regularly with Minute staff to get that budget in place on what they actually think they're going to spend. One of the things that they were doing also is they currently we have approximately 5 FTEs at Minute that are unfilled positions, okay? And when they budget for us, they say that they're going to fill those positions, and that amount never gets adjusted throughout the year. Well, we know that, and we budget for it. So we bring our budget at MDBA in line with what, in fact, we think they're going to spend. However, we may have $2 to $3 million worth of projects that we want to do, but they're only going to be in line to do about $1 million. And so we've had meetings this year, in fact, to get them to be more realistic on what they can do.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Powers, so what you're saying that the shortfall was a result of not having a good communication between Minute and what they are just going to spend on your agency behalf?
Mr. Powers.
Representative. Yes. I mean, we work together now, and we have a good sense of what we're going to spend in a given year. To your question about what we have done beyond that, because we had issues between the homes too, is that we meet on a quarterly basis with the administrators and the business managers. Senior management meets with them. I'm there, and we go over their budget to see where they're at. That was not in place prior to that.
And Mr. Chair?
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Powers, so how much was that? How much was it that you had a discrepancy between you and Minute? How was the amount? Was that the total $10
million? Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, sorry, I've tried to find this here.
It's fine. Take your time.
$5.3 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I have Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you explain to the committee, you know how many beds you have, how many residents you have, you know, what percentage of disability they might have? Can you then take a look at that, your residents, and know how much of this is federal funds that are coming in? And then can you take a look at that and then see what your revenue is coming in and how much then you would need from the state? Is it as simple as that? Probably not, but...
Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, it's not that simple. No, it's not. You have the two things at play. You have what they're actually going to receive per diem. If they're over 70%, they're going to receive the higher amount, which means they don't have to pay for their cost of care. And the assumption is that we have that $400 and some is going to cover the cost of their care. Now we have some veterans that are likely beyond that $400 that we're providing additional care to. However, we may have some other veterans that are at the 70% or above that don't need as much care, but they are a 70%er. Then we have the given fact that we don't know what their, when they enter the home, whether they have the ability to pay. Okay? So, as you know, there's a transfer of assets prior to them entering a home, and it's different than what at the federal level than it is at the state level. And so they, in essence, can unload their assets prior to entering the home and enter the home, and they're not going to have to pay the cost of care, and the general fund will pick it up.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, and just a quick follow-up. I agree with Chair Anderson. Are you taking steps now to try to eliminate the problem we had last session?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, I can assure the committee we are on the right track now, and this will not happen again.
Okay. Mr. Powers, if I could, just before we go on to other member questions, what are those steps that you're taking? What have you come up with? And help us understand that, because that's a pretty salient question. I'm sure all of the members are wondering is, this is an important area, and we want to know what it is you're doing.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we have taken steps. We have a better communication process going on. We have a better budgeting process going on. But there is the need for a reserve within that special revenue, because we are receiving federal funds. So at any time, if we have a sequester or whatever, those funds could be cut off. Okay? And if that happens at the end of a fiscal year, then we're going to be left without the funds to cover our costs. And we can't very well just shut down beds. So there is a need, and due to the uncertainty of the revenues, we have to have the need to have a reserve in there. Okay.
Mr. Powers, again, I looked around the table, and we're all very curious. You said you have better communications and you have a better budgeting process. Can you get us what that looks like and how it is, what you've done mechanically to do that? Because I'm sure I speak for all of us. This is certainly an area that we want to make sure is done well. It's very important. But every day we hear from agencies, and we want to know what steps have you taken from a quality improvement perspective, and what is it that you're doing that's a best practices effort? Because I've heard nothing specific other than you're going to promise that it doesn't happen again. And on behalf of our veterans, I think that we should be looking into this a little more closely than what you provided for us. So if you don't have that now, perhaps you can get us that soon?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I can do that for you.
Okay, and we'll have staff work with your group to make sure we get that quickly. I have other member questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, I asked this question yesterday. I'm going to ask you as well because you were talking about minute. My assumption is that the staff time and the IT time that's been dedicated to you previously to the establishment of the minute, you had people on your, that I can use the term payroll or your staff to perform those functions. Is that correct? Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll. For the most part, it is. But, you know, as an enterprise, their idea is to be able to move people among other agencies. We don't see it a lot, but we, you know, our CIO and our head IT staff person is shared with the Minnesota Department of Health. So there's some sharing going on there. At the same time, they're also moving some of the direct costs centrally, and they're calling them enterprise, and they're going to charge us enterprise rates. For instance, when we go into 18 and 19, they're going to charge us for desktop support. As it is now, they purchase the computers, and we see that cost. Okay, that's going to be moving centrally now, and they're going to say, well, we're going to charge you so much for a desktop support. That staff is moving. The help desk moved. So there's that shifting going on. So we have a little less oversight of what is actually happening. We've watched their budget on what they're spending because we're getting the bill for it, so we know what they're spending. We're going to lose sight of that as they move to a more centralized area and where people are actually working.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, as a part of that recentralization or decentralization of services, do you have extra space within your organization of people who would have been providing those services within your agency that you now have to still continue to provide space for somebody who is technically an employee of a different agency?
Mr. Powers. Representative. Yes, we do have space right now. We don't pay rent over at the Minneapolis campus, and that's where they reside.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, do you bill minute for the costs associated with housing those individuals within your area because of the heat, the lights, the desks, the other kinds of things that are just associated with your daily operations?
Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chairman. Representative, no.
Thank you.
Representative Driscoll, anything else? Okay, I have Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, you mentioned something a little bit ago about veterans unloading their assets or divesting themselves of their assets and things, and then the cost of care, of course, is picked up by the state. What is the look back on that in terms of, are there different rules for veterans versus IRS rules for look back?
Mr. Powers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe it's a 1-year look back.
Representative Uglum?
Well, I'm not a tax accountant, but I know.
Mr. Powers, if you feel the need to bring up other folks to the testifier table, please feel free. And if you would, for the record, state your name and who you represent.
I'm Deputy Commissioner Douglas Hughes.
Mr. Hughes.
Deputy Commissioner, could you answer that? I mean, what is the look back?
Chair and representative for the veterans who go into our homes, under Rule 9050, there is a one-day look back for spouse and there is a one-year look back for children. So it is far different than if you were MA and had the 5-year look back.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. would it be safe to say then that it is quite easy, and I'm all for veterans, believe me, and everything else, but it seems like it's quite easy to enter veterans home here in Minnesota, divest yourself of all of your assets in a very timely manner and get complete care paid for.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair, Representative, that's not my call, sir. If you want to ask me, I would say based on my experience working in long-term care with the Minneapolis VA, the federal VA, it is an advantage.
Okay.
Representative Hughlin?
I guess I do have one other one while I'm on this. Perhaps it's for Mr. Powers again, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Powers?
Mr. Powers, you also mentioned a little earlier about your bed availability at the Hastings home. And in an earlier slide, we looked at areas where you do have your homes. Has there ever been any thought about consolidating or moving some of these homes? For instance, you have one in Silver Bay. I looked at that and I went, my goodness, why isn't it in Duluth? It would seem to be much more logical. And if the Hastings home is being underutilized, has there ever been any thought about driving some efficiencies and doing some combinations or moving these homes?
Mr. Powers.
Chair, if I may.
By all means, please do.
Chair, Representative, a key point is that the home in Hastings is a domiciliary. It's a board and care rather than a skilled nursing facility. So it is for veterans who are basically looking at the rehabilitation opportunities. It's not a skilled nursing home like the Minneapolis home is. The Minneapolis home does have a 50-bed domiciliary available, but they're different types of care provided at Hastings and Minneapolis. But there is work within the agency, work at consolidating the domiciliary, which is the board and care opportunities that Hastings and Minneapolis currently provide. I hope that answers.
Mr. Chair, just one other follow-up then. So what does it cost the agency to have open beds and not being utilized?
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Powers?
Chair, I don't know that answer off the top of my head.
And I believe you're coming back next week. Perhaps you can bring that if you don't have it at your fingertips.
We do not.
Chair, Mr. Representative, we can provide that information, a cost analysis of what an empty bed means for MDVA.
Right.
Representative Hughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's just good business practices to know that and to understand the dynamics there of underutilization of your assets. So, yeah, I'd like to see that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hughlin.
If I could make one other comment about consolidating the homes or whatever and why they are in Silver Bay and whatnot. When someone retires to a veteran home, they sort of want to stay in their community and so that their relatives can visit them and whatnot. And that's why it's the same way with the cemeteries. They kind of spread out the cemeteries throughout Minnesota so that they're generally within the area that, in the case of a cemetery where they died, that their relatives are around. The same thing with the veterans that go into the home so that they're in their community.
I have another member question. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding is there are some federal restrictions and enablement required if you're going to open, move, or adjust. Is there a brief statement you can make about the flexibility constrictions from the federal government on being able to, I think, address what was hinted at?
Mr. Johnson?
Chair, Representative Quam. There are guidelines for where veterans' homes will be located in terms of new construction and how much the federal VA will provide for new homes construction. There's some misleading information about how far a veteran's home needs to be from a border or from another veteran's home. In terms of where they're located, the veterans' homes came back under the purview of MDVA in 2007, I believe. But they had been long established in terms of location, and we've just continued to maintain and improve them as best we can based on their existing location. And quite frankly, have continued to try and provide information to communities that are looking to add veterans homes in their area as well. So there are always conversations within the agency about homes locations and how we best serve veterans in the state of Minnesota. But at this point, there are conversations, and we look to the legislature and the governor to help dictate where and how we manage those locations. Chair.
Representative Quam. Nothing further. Okay, before we move on with your testimony, I wanted to take another pause to ask you a question. You said just a second ago that Minute, who is a provider, they're essentially your vendor, they provide you estimates, and that essentially they're telling you what they are going to provide, and there seems to be a pretty heavy disconnect. And I work in IT, and I'm in the business world, and that's never how it works. So if you could help me understand, why is it that the vendor is telling the person who is utilizing the vendor's services is driving the ship, and instead of you saying, this is what we need, and if you are our vendor, you will provide it? Because there's a fairly costly disconnect from what you're telling us, and I'm just really curious as to why is it that you've allowed that to perpetuate?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meade. I think there's a certain level of service that they have decided to provide to each of the agencies, whether from a security aspect to make sure that agencies are standardized. However, I'm not sure the year that it was became law, but they, in fact, were the only vendor that we could use, and they sort of dictate, in some cases, they may dictate what we have to do.
And if I could just, before we pursue the rest of my questioning, apparently your cell phone may or may not be causing the buzzing. So if you would maybe put it on a chair behind you or in a lead-lined bag or, you know, something.
Sure, sorry about
that. Yeah, it's sort of a process of elimination with some of the microphones. So, you know, I appreciate that answer, but again, I mean, we've all, and for new members, Minute is a work in progress, but I'm just really curious as to how is it that a group that exists to serve the needs of the agencies and is providing this as a chargeback service, how in the world do you let them drive the ship? I'm just curious. And so, Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, I guess the question, maybe he can expound on it. I thought he just said that they were required to use it. Is that's the only one that they're allowed to use? Is that correct?
Representative Green, Powers.
Chair, committee. Yes, we have to use Minute. By law, we have to use Minute.
So, Mr. Chair, then maybe it's up to us to look for that solution.
Representative Green, I think that's an excellent solution there, and that's where I was headed. I'm trying to help you out because it just blows my mind. Representative Anderson has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think a lot of these questions surrounding Minute will be good topics of conversation when we do have Minute come before the committee. I think for us it would be helpful if you can delineate for us what they said their services were going to be provided to you and how that is differed from past practices for you in your IT needs. So if you can kind of give us an IT budget based on previous history and then now your current situation, I think that would give us a better idea of where we're at. For members that aren't familiar with the change, it was a bipartisan change with the thought and idea that if we put this in place, we would see a cost savings because it does make sense for us to have major purchases of IT going through one vendor because we can capitalize on the volume that we have as a state. I think it's a better question of perhaps we need to give greater direction to Minute and how they achieve that goal. And those are some things that we'll have to dig down into. And so each of the agencies that come before us, I think that we need to have that conversation of what are their IT's needs currently and what were they prior to the change in the law, and see if there's a huge disconnect or not, and if there is, why is that? So, I mean, I think those are some really good questions that we'll need to have going forward for each one of the agencies that come before us.
Charles, back to your presentation. I know we took a little bit of a pause, but go ahead.
Yeah, go to the next one.
The next one is your.
Mr. Chair, committee members, here, in fact, I show you how, I won't walk through this step-by-step unless, of course, you want me to, but this shows, in fact, how we determine what the cost of care is. The top two lines going across is how we determine what the cost of care is, and then below the last set of three boxes there, the last lines show a typical 70%er cost of care minus the full VA per diem, and then the next slide actually shows what the VA per diem rates are. So if you look above there in Minneapolis, the current 70% full VA per diem rate is $443 a day. Outstate is $390 a day. The lower VA per diem rate is $106 versus the $443. Domiciliary is only $45 a day, and the adult daycare is $84 a day. Off to the right there is our daily cost of care for each of the different veterans' homes and the level of care. So if you go back. So back to this illustration here. So the 70%er has no resident maintenance charge. The veteran resident that receives the regular VA per diem is then adjusted based on their ability to pay, and then the resident is responsible for the maintenance charge and is adjusted for income, and general fund appropriation covers the remainder. In the case of a non-veteran spouse, the cost of care minus the income adjusted. The resident pays the full cost of care, and then the general fund picks up the rest, whatever they can't afford. No, go one back one. So this is a depiction of actually how we fund the Minnesota Veterans Homes. So we have those three types of revenue, major types of revenue coming in for the maintenance. Is based on the full cost of care. It's charged to the resident. General fund appropriation this current year is $57.9 million. And then we have the per diems and the Medicare and A, B, and D. And I've got a note on that on the next slide. And then below is actually what's included in the cost of care versus what's excluded.
Chair, if I may, the previous slide and this slide, and members of the committee, is our attempt at a visual representation of the complexity of how we operate and finance the homes. We tried to include as much information as possible in a way that could be digested, but as you can see, it's not easily digested. So any questions, we're happy to respond directly to individuals or to the committee. Again, next week, happy to follow up. This is basically our attempt to break it down into a visual.
This next slide, Mr. Chairman, committee members, are the major health care revenues that we take in. And this is, again, we look at the maintenance charges. They're fairly consistent. And this is even after, in I believe it was fiscal year 14, we had double-digit increases in the cost of care, and it literally had no impact on the amount of revenue that we took in. So this was one of the factors that we saw that determined the extra additional amounts that we felt like we needed to operate the homes because of the leveling off of the total revenue. There's a footnote down there. Additional revenue is received for the Medicare D reimbursement of $1.3 million, and then currently we only received during fiscal year 16, $139,000 for Medicare B reimbursements, which lends to the to let you know that we are becoming CMS compliant. We have Building 19 and Building 21 that are now CMS compliant, so we can bill for Medicare. However, the what we can bill Medicare for is very limited right now. We have, I believe, Silver Bay is just about ready to be.
Silver Bay is?
Silver Bay is CMS compliant, and so is Laverne now, too. So we do some therapy. We can bill back for some of the therapy services. The real money in for CMS Medicare is in the Medicare A, which we typically don't see very much of at all.
Let's stop you there for a second. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain to the committee what CMF compliance means?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair, Representative? The term is they're CMS certified. So what you do is you get you have CMS Center for Medicare and Medicaid, which is the, in my opinion, is the federal gold standard for long-term care facilities or nursing home care facilities. In addition to that, quality, which of course should be our number one concern, then it also allows you to get reimbursement from the Part A, which is called transitional care, to where you may be getting therapies back into from a hospital stay. And then Part B is considered outpatient services, but we can still bill for that at the homes, even though they don't have what's considered a, I don't want to get too technical, but a Medicare qualifying stay. If you've ever heard of that, caring for someone, which is a three-day overnight stay in an acute care facility. Mm-hmm. And Part C, which is an advantage plan, something similar to that. Those revenues, we can bill for them, but they're minimal. But Part D, which is the medication portion, that's where the bulk of our money is coming from. And in addition to that, there's an initiative that we've embarked on, which is to lower our costs of medication and increase our reimbursement from Part D and from the VA. There were some misses in the past year because of the complexities of collecting reimbursement from Part D and from the VA, which we have since rectified.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you.
Please proceed.
What? Chair, members of the committee, that is about all we have in terms of an overview for the budget portion. Next up is the healthcare overview, and then programs and services. So any additional questions at this point for Mr. Powers? We're happy to.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the notation on the bottom where you've got the, 1.3 and then 100 and some thousand, and you're talking about improving facilities in order to allow for additional revenue by billing from federal programs. Do you have the information that you can share with us later of what the actual total revenue is? Because when I add up, or is it included in maintenance charges, it doesn't appear like those additional things fit into the three that add up for your total. And it, which right now it's about 2%, maybe last year was a percent. It'd be nice to see that growth, and that might help us understand in future needs and totals.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not sure I quite understand what you're suggesting. That $1.3 million and the $139 are not included in any of those numbers above.
Representative Kwong?
Right, and there was, thank you, Mr. Chair, and there was discussion about your improving, updating so you qualify, so you can then get additional revenue from these Medicare, Medicaid sources, which means that there'd be additional revenue, but it doesn't show on your total revenue charts. It'd be nice to see and have the historical look at what's captured, because you're obviously investing to improve revenue,
but it doesn't help this committee if we don't see what the actual total revenue is.
Representative, the biggest portion of this right now is Medicare D, and that's growing over the years. But I see what you're suggesting. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Powers, I was reading through the recent Office of Legislative Auditor report, and I see that they state that generally adequate internal controls over your financial operations, and you generally complied with the significant finance-related legal requirements. So more or less a satisfactory report from the OLA. One issue that did concern me was in terms of they cited a couple of findings to pay attention to. One was the special needs benefit, which was up to $5 million in expenditures, and they thought that seemingly that the legislature needed to determine some more specific and appropriate guidelines for those benefits. Is there a plan, as far as you know, at this point to move forward with maybe clarifying? It looked like something that was important to provide, the special needs benefits, but it wasn't specified in statute as to what that entailed. Could you address that just briefly?
You would introduce yourself to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm Brad Lindsay. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Department. Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the special needs program is really one of our most utilized programs. It's right now we do it under our State Soldiers Assistance Program. It's a very big piece of our homeless initiatives. Most of that assistance we're providing is assisting veterans who are behind on their rents and their mortgages and things like that, who have had some kind of life event that's got them into some trouble, and we've helped to bail them out. We believe the statute contains enough for us to actually be authorized to provide the service. The one thing the department was definitely deficient in, and which we realized and have implemented now, is our rules. When the department added that program, I believe in 2007, they came to these committees and they testified and they got the additional funding for them, but then they never went back and did administrative rules on how those things are to be done. They just kind of developed internal policies and procedures. So right before we had the OLA, we had started and initiated the rules process, which I believe was in September. And we're working through that now, and hopefully we'll have that rules process completed in 2018.
Senator Johnson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I think, as you stated, those benefits, particularly for some of the issues around homelessness for our veterans, is so essential. I hope you can get that clarified and make it make it clear that those benefits are provided. Thank you, Mr.
Johnson.
Mr. Chair.
I believe that we're going to be picking this up on Tuesday. We'll be getting a lot more detail on this on Tuesday. So,
very good. Thank you.
That'll be a good time for us to talk again.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to your presentation,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Powers had a comment to the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I just want to point out that, you know, going into the next budget here, what we do know is that we're going to have an additional $5.5 million worth of salary and insurance increases that we're going to have to contend with in the next biennium. This is already known. Those would be the negotiated step increases that are in current contract, and regardless of whether a contract gets passed this next biennium, those individuals continue to receive those performance increases, which we estimated to be about $3 million, and then an additional $2.5 million of known insurance increases that we're going to have to contend with also. So I just want to make everybody aware of that.
Mr. Powers, question, is that performance or step increases?
Mr. Chairman, it's the same, yes, the step increases.
Just want to make sure I heard that right.
Yes.
Thank you. Back to you.
So, Chair and members of the committee, we've already been introduced to Deputy Commissioner Hughes, and he is in charge of the Veterans Healthcare side of the agency, which is the largest by FTE and general fund appropriation. Of particular interest to us are the number of Minnesotans that are aging, expected to age over the next 15 to 20 years. The number of 65 and older is expected to outpace the K through 12 age group by 2020 for the first time in history. How that affects our agency is that last bullet point. The ability to have qualified and available caregivers is becoming more challenging because as an agency, our veterans' homes are competing for the same employees in the healthcare provision that private enterprise is, whether it be community-based long-term care or even hospitals and clinics. So this is a big challenge that we're facing, and in terms of our agency's ability to serve veterans that are looking for long-term care, this is a huge demographic. If you recall from earlier, the number of veterans in Minnesota that are Vietnam era, about 125,000 out of the 360. So it's a big bump in who we will be serving. Our five homes, we've alluded to a few of them. Our largest in terms of beds is at Minneapolis. We also have the domiciliary care at Hastings, up Silver Bay on the North Shore, Fergus Falls in west central Minnesota, and then Laverne in southwest Minnesota. Our homes provide the primary care, both physicians and nurse practitioners, 24-hour skilled nursing. We've got, I believe it's 10 buildings that are 24/7 residents for our residences for our residents, veterans, and spouses. We focus on dementia, specialty care units, memory loss, domiciliaries, the board and care that is at Hastings and the smaller unit at Minneapolis. And then a new program is the Adult Daycare Center.
Mr. Johnson, if you would.
Yes, sir.
Representative Kunesh-Podin, you have a question.
I do have a quick question. You have listed all of these different veterans' homes, but what I don't understand is why, like the veterans' home up in St. Cloud or the veterans' hospital, why that isn't included in any of that, and if there are other ones, I don't know if that's a whole different agency or what, but I grew up in that area, and I'm just kind of curious why it's not included in any of this.
Certainly.
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative, I'd actually like to invite Deputy Commissioner Hughes to talk about the various organizations and government entities that provide these sorts of services. The one in St. Cloud that you're referencing is a federal VA facility, but they are partners, and Mr. Hughes has an extensive experience with the federal VA, so I'm happy to turn it over to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've worked for both agencies. I worked for 5 years with the Minneapolis VA healthcare system, which I have had interactions with the other federal VAs in the state. We are in theory, separate agencies. One is federal, one is state. We may work in conjunction, as one of the previous slides mentioned. We work with the Minneapolis VA. We work with the St. Cloud VA, Fargo, and Sioux Falls, and the various community-based outpatient clinics in the state. There are some services such as community-based services that come out of those federal facilities, which is what I did previous with the Minneapolis VA. They really, truly are two totally separate agencies.
Representative Kunesh-Podin.
Thank you.
Okay. Back to you.
So the veterans' homes, in addition to those services that I outlined, veterans' homes focus on rehab services, including occupational physical therapy and physical fitness, social services, dental optometry, hearing care, transportation to federal VA health services at the various federal VA facilities, drug and alcohol treatment, work therapy. And our brag slide for the homes is we've been consistently awarded best-in-class ratings in things like quality of stay, the treatment and dignity that veterans are receiving,
The nursing care is top-notch, meet and exceed safety requirements. The facilities are clean. I would extend an invitation to any and all in this committee to visit. The most accessible one to from St. Paul is the Minneapolis home, but we're very proud of the facility. There's been some major improvements I'm going to talk about a little bit later, capital improvements in replacement beds, replacing buildings that were outdated that required legislative support to get done. I'm going to highlight a few of those in a couple of slides here. We get a question about the breakdown of beds. This is how it is currently laid out. Earlier we talked about Hastings. Representative Ugham is interested in understanding sort of efficiencies. The domiciliary at Hastings is not a skilled nursing facility. There are some support available, and there are transits from Hastings to the Minneapolis VA to make sure that our veterans have access to the health care. Laverne and Silver Bay are very similar in size. And then Minneapolis, again, the 291 skilled nursing beds and 50 domiciliary board and care. We don't talk about specifically, but the adult day center is an opportunity for veterans to come in that are staying at their home. They can come in and get services, get medication, get meals, get assistance with bathing and cleaning. And it also gives their spouse or caregiver a break, so they have a few hours during the day when they can take care of themselves, which is a huge issue for veterans who are in their homes and are not a part of the residences. I was talking about some of these capital improvements that we're proud of and we'd love to show off. Building 19 has been open for a few years now. Almost a year ago, Building 21, the grand opening was held and is fully operational. And Building 22, the shell is completed now. It looks like the building it will be, but it's not completed. I've got a couple of renderings, an overview of Building 21, which is open.
Mr. Johnson, if I could.
Oh, yes, sir.
Representative Anderson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the adult daycare portion, Mr. Johnson. So when we went around the state last year, we got a lot of feedback of people wanting to have some kind of care that's closer to home. Have you guys explored the option of utilizing private facilities to accommodate an adult daycare program for folks that are close to home?
Johnson. Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is where the federal VA and the MDVA kind of deviate. So I can speak extensively to the Minneapolis VA and lightly to the Sioux Falls and the Fargo VA, which serves Minnesota. There are programs such as the Adult Day Program. There is one that for the federal VA that's over on 66th and Cedar. In addition to that, they have numerous vendors that they do business with. One of them is Ebenezer, and there's a whole bunch of other daycare centers. I can give you the statistics if you'd like on those, but it's a very large and robust program from the Minneapolis VA. The Fargo VA and the Sioux Falls VA have similar programs, but they're not as large because of the rurality of the state in the western part of the state, but they do have similar programs. And as far as the nursing home part of it, the long-term care, the Minneapolis VA, we had 63 nursing homes under contract, private homes. So if you're from the Twin Cities, you may know Southview Acres. If you're from Chisholm, you may know Heritage Manor. And we have some in Wisconsin as well. And the difference with those is that those are for highly service-connected veterans only. So those would be generally your 70% service connection disability that were authorized to do that. There's some other nuances of others. In addition to that, hospice. All veterans who are signed up for VHA benefits and are in hospice, they are eligible to use that benefit regardless of their service connection.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, the testifiers, I guess the federal government puts a restriction on the number of rest home beds in each state, as I understand it. So I guess my question is, where is that cap now in terms of number of beds that's allowed, and where is Minnesota at? With respect to that,
Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Johnson?
If you look at the number of beds, one of the slides demonstrates the number of beds, if Mr. Johnson wants to go to that. Those are the total number of beds that we have in the state that are current, that we consider what we would consider a bed day of care for each of those different facilities. We do have a number. There's a number on top of that that we're authorized under, I believe it's 38 CFR 59, that the number is
the total
number is 1,058.
Chair, Representative Johnson, to your question, we have a statewide cap of 1,058 beds that the feds recognize and allocate to receive federal pay for. Okay. We are not built out to that level. The number that we currently target is about 144 beds available that we could build. So we don't have that capacity yet. That number is dictated by both census and veteran numbers by the federal VA, and the challenge that we face in Minnesota is, although 369,000 veterans seems like a, or 361,000 seems like a pretty large number, there are a lot of Sun Belt states and southern states that have a much larger veteran population as a percentage of their population living within those states, and that demographic number really plays a role in how many beds the VA will allocate per state. So in terms of Minnesota, we have 1,058 federally recognized beds. We have the ability to add about 144 more, but that's kind of where we're at, and those are the numbers we're currently using. And our agency tries to get information out to anyone who asks to answer that question and say, here's where we're at, and here's how we have to follow the federal code and the federal VA in terms of allocating those beds and where they would go. So,
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Complicated. My follow up is, given there's 144 beds that one could have additionally, do you support building an additional veterans home in Minnesota? Is that something that your department is supportive of?
Chair Johnson, Representative Johnson, we're supportive of building as many veterans homes as the feds will allow and the state can pay for. The challenge that we're not supportive of specific locations. The legislature and the governor would dictate if someone said, I'd like to build a home. Every year there are proposals to build veterans homes, state veterans homes. And as an agency, we're happy to provide as much information as support as necessary to get on the federal application waiting list to receive federal funding. The feds will pay 65% of the cost of construction. Again, the challenge sort of relating to that 1,058 bed count number is we only have about 144 available. There are states that have allocations of over 2,000 or 3,000 and only have 800 beds currently built. So they're higher on the priority list than we are. So the challenge, again, is the state has to allocate 35% of the construction costs, has to come up with a five-year plan for paying for those facilities to be maintained and operated, and paying for 3 years of payment for the operation and 5 years of planning before we can even submit an application. So we're supportive of new homes, and we're happy to help with the process. We've worked with communities to try and develop proposals and meet the federal requirements to get an application in the queue. But we don't select the sites. We leave that to the legislature to hear construction requests and operating cost requests. And then if it happens, we support it. We staff it. We operate it. And Deputy Commissioner Hughes would make sure that it happens to the highest standards. But
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That context was helpful to me, so appreciate it.
Representative Quam.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And the Chair had touched on, and Representative Johnson had touched on, you have cooperative agreements with other homes outside of your network, and it seemed to indicate when you responded that there are quite a few in the maybe 13-county metro. How many of those are actually in greater Minnesota and then also in areas that are more than an hour away from one of your facilities? In other words, if you can't build and you're utilizing other facilities, are they someplace that's a bit distant so that then the it's would be close to their home?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned before, those are federal VA contracted homes.
Mr. Chair, I thought that there was a discussion of they cooperated with like nursing homes or other facilities for beds because you haven't built and you've got an increased one. Or did I misunderstand? So you don't have anything cooperative outside of you and the VA to utilize, you know, like a nursing home or other for adult daycare and other services so that you've got large parts of the state that you're talking several hours of drive to get to anything?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, as I was explaining what is available to veterans, because regardless of federal and state, we serve veterans. And there is a distinction. Those are contracted beds by the various federal VAs. As I mentioned before, those are only for 70% service-connected or higher veterans or those that are on hospice. So we don't utilize as a state agency those contracts.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. I can hopefully find out offline because when I attended some ceremonies in Fort Benning, some of those young men live a bit of a distance and did suffer service-related injuries. And I know that there are volunteers that drive vans to get them. But when I heard that they're through the VA or some organization that there are options, it'd be nice for us to know what they are so that we can communicate and they wouldn't spend so much time on the road, for different things. So that I apologize. It's convoluted, but, frankly, this is a very convoluted federal-state interaction.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, having worked in both systems, when I used to answer the phone over at the Minneapolis VA, one of the first things I used to say was, it's complicated. Because getting into the VA, even to, if you use the Minneapolis VA 1100 number, you may not get to where you're going that day. So we make sure that, and it's gotten much better, I can tell you, because I use the 1100 number myself, and it's gotten extremely, it's really actually very good right now. But at any time, since I've worked in both systems, I will be glad to share that information. I know that we just received a request from DHS for those Minneapolis VA, the federal VA contracted homes, and as they are part of the larger VA federal network, we can certainly get you those homes that are out of Fargo or Sioux Falls.
Representative Kwan? Good. Representative Detmer.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it was brought up earlier, question about private nursing homes. And I know there are some private nursing homes in the state that have gone through the federal certification process. It's a pretty hard thing to do. Could you explain that? I don't know how many private nursing homes are in the state, but I know they have to jump through hoops to get that certification.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I was the contracting officer representative for the Minneapolis VA, so I did work on the contracting language. I did work on the selection of those for the Minneapolis VA. I did work on the inspection of those. I did work on the when there was a sentinel event or an occurrence. I did work on those as well as my newly hired senior director for healthcare. It's not a – I can speak more specifically to Minneapolis, but they overlap because the contracting office out of the Minneapolis Federal VA handles all the nursing home contracts for those other VAs. And the necessary thing to do is when – For example, Hayward was just brought on not that long ago, which is it's a very recent example, though, in Wisconsin. We asked them to go work with their CVSO and other organizations in the area to give us some demographics and some of who veterans in the area, the need, that sort of thing. We use in the federal VA, the goal is to have a federal veterinary contracted nursing home about 50 miles away from the other one. So the greatest distance you would have to travel is about 25 miles. The Minneapolis VA contracting officer will take that nursing home and walk them through FedBizOps, which is a website that you have to go through to fill out all the paperwork, all the different requirements that go through there. All of this is dependent on what's called in the federal government an open solicitation. So they can announce, we can provide announcements, which is what we do to certain nursing home groups. They apply. I sat on the evaluation committee. We have a certain amount of criteria that we would go through. If they scored in a certain level, they would go on to the next level. Then myself and the other person from the Minneapolis VA would go out and personally inspect that nursing home. And then if all of that came together and we did have a need for that area, then we provided them with a contract.
Representative Detmer. Mr. Chair, and do you know how many of those private nursing homes are in Minnesota right now?
I can only answer for the Minneapolis VA. Well, we had 63. Some of those were in western Wisconsin. So if I'm going to go back, I would have to say probably because St. Cloud has a very limited amount. Mm-hmm. They may have 9 because they use their CLC, or their Community Living Center, extensively for long-term care. I might say 80. Plus, I could certainly check with Ms. Carolyn Schauer, who is the Vision 23 Extended Care and Rehab Executive.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, members, in the interest of time, we've got about 6.5 minutes left. We're going to let you go through your presentation, maybe a Cliff Notes version of the remaining slides, and if not, we can maybe address some of it when you're back next week.
Sure. Chair, I'd be happy to get through these. So I mentioned Building 21 and Building 22 are the new construction, leveraging state bonding along with federal partnership for money to get these done. 22 is the shell is in place, but not yet complete. Programs and Services is the other division. Mr. Powers represented earlier that it's the smaller of the two divisions that we've got. Deputy Commissioner Lindsay is here with us. If we have any specific questions, you can get them to me either now or offline, and I'll make sure that Deputy Commissioner Lindsay is able to address any that I can't. Programs and Services assists eligible veterans and their dependents and survivors to access benefits that they've earned. Quick overview in programs is the SSAP, which was referenced, that includes the special needs grant. Our state veteran cemeteries, we've got Little Falls and Preston, which are open. Duluth will be opening. Target date is midsummer of 2018. Veterans Preference, Veterans SOAR, which is our a newer initiative to help veterans access SSI and SSDI, which is Social Security benefits. Our homelessness initiative, which is combating veterans at risk of homelessness as well as those currently homeless. Our 1-888 Link Vet phone number is a nation-leading program giving access to a phone number for people who have questions about veterans' issues or health care, education, or otherwise. It's staffed 24/7. Excuse me, it's staffed during business hours, but it is answered, and they are trained individuals to answer that phone line. We've got Minnesota Service Corps, which is our primary partner with Corps is Lutheran Social Services. That is financial counseling, family counseling, chemical dependency counseling. It is an opportunity to get services to veterans that we as an agency might not directly provide. Services, we've got our claims assistance offices in St. Paul and Fargo. Our staff represent veterans and their dependents looking for things like compensation or pension claims, helping them get into that portion of the federal VA system.
We also have field and tribal operations, which is our way of reaching out to communities that are either geographically or may not normally seek assistance because of cultural differences, but we have assistance representatives dedicated to reaching out to individuals who wouldn't necessarily make it to an office. They might be on a reservation or might be sort of geographically challenged to access our services, and so we will communicate with them. Our women's veterans program has stood up over the last couple of years, again, trying to respond to that spike in women veterans, the increase that we expect. Our higher education veterans program, Minnesota GI Bill, it's OJT and apprenticeship and opportunities. We partner with DEED, trying to find veterans access to education that they need in order to get along with their careers after they've come back to the civilian world. State approving agency is a partnership with the federal VA that makes sure that the programs that we are working on, education and training, meet the requirements for state and federal criteria to make sure that veterans are getting the highest education that they can. Again, that's a partnership with the federal VA. Our grants programs, we have a grant specialist who helps with the pass-through grants and legislatively mandated grants through to the veteran service organizations, the county veteran service officers. We assist with the offices of the county veteran service officers, although they are paid by the counties. So they are county employees, but we help them do their job by providing a pass-through grant from the general fund to them. Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans has been focused on veterans' homelessness. And then earlier there were some numbers indicating Support Our Troops grants, which is a new program that we're utilizing. The funding that is collected from people who purchase the Support Our Troops license plates, that money goes into a fund that MDVA and Military Affairs divides, and we're utilizing it to help with grant applications for programs that will help veterans. And so if you have an idea that you think will help veterans, you can submit an application and say, this is a program I'd like to get some funding for. People who have donated money through the SOT license plate fund, that money then is utilized in grants that meet the requirements, and the board, our partners in veteran service organizations and within the agency, look at grant applications and say, yeah, this is a great idea to help veterans, and we'd like to support it.
Mr. Johnson, we're right at time, and I wanted to make one closing comment. For members here, all of us have met veterans in our districts. You are a great liaison to help with any concerns. I'm sure you'll be able to circulate members and members field questions to you.
Yes.
So
pretty straightforward. Ben.Johnson@state.mn.us.
I think we can all get that.
Yeah.
All right. We look forward to having you back next week. And members, with that, we are adjourned.